Hi, I'm Dave Reinersman, and welcome to The Marvels of Science, a podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains, from Ultron and Jarvis to Friday and Edith. And speaking of all these artificial characters, in more ways than one, today's topic is artificial intelligence. Here with me to figure out just how advanced our current AIs are and whether Jarvis is futuristic or just a pipe dream is Ronan Tamari, our science expert today. Ronan is an AI researcher and PhD candidate at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem with expertise in computational systems for natural language understanding. Welcome to the show, Ronan.
Hi. Hi, Dave. Great to be here.
And our color commentator is Caroline Bailey, a friend of mine here in DC who works in international development. Thanks for coming on the show, Caroline.
Thanks. Great to be here, Dave.
A warning to listeners before we start. If you're listening where your home automation system can hear me, then Alexa, play Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up. Also, you might want to put in headphones from here on. I'm assuming her name will come up again. I was very proud of that joke, by the way. Okay, to the topic. Back in episode 5, robots, we touched on things like natural language user interfaces, machine learning, and the robot apocalypse with Liz Schmidt and robotics engineer Po Chakrabarty. In this episode, we're going to focus on the meaning behind some of those things, not the metal bodies that they're sometimes housed in the MCU.
Your clunky metal suits are going to be left in the dust.
The most well-known artificial intelligence in the Marvel Universe is Jarvis, whose name is an acronym for Just Another Rather Very Intelligent System. Tony Stark, who built Jarvis, tells us...
Started out, Jarvis was just a natural language UI.
And we'll get to that in a minute. First, Caroline, what comes to your mind when you think of artificial intelligence, Marvel or otherwise?
I think for me, most recently, it is just like what you were saying before, Alexa. And yes, she's probably listening to me right now because I have two of them in my house. And my parents actually got them first before I did, which is really weird because my parents are not high tech. And I was like super freaked out by it. I was like, this is a really bad idea. Like, I know they tell you that they're not listening to you all the time, but they're totally listening to you all the time. And I was like, they're going to record all this information and this is not good. But then I sort of like watched my parents use them and saw the like utility value in them. And I was kind of like, okay, like maybe this isn't that bad. But then my mom, and she just for context, she doesn't work. She's a stay-at-home mom. So I think she gets a little bit lonely at the house. And so, she started sort of like responding to them as if they were human, which also really freaked me out. So I used to like kind of yell at her when she would be like, thank you, after, you know, Alexa did something. I was like, don't do that. And she was like, why? I was like, because as soon as the machines learn emotions and like become more human, I was like, that's when we lose. I was like, haven't you ever watched like this kind of a movie? I was like, don't do that. But she still does it. So I guess that's what I think about most when I think about it, is like how I guess it's sort of entering our real lives now. And it's not just in a movie anymore.
So these are sort of our current attempts at Jarvis, Google Assistant or Siri or Alexa or whatever. What do you think of their ability to actually understand what you're talking about? Like their accuracy, I suppose.
I've been pretty disappointed often. Like even the simple things you say, like, okay, Google, I live in Israel, so a lot of my friends don't have like Anglo names. Like, I don't know, call Amit. And that sounds like Amit. So it's like, what are you saying? And I just have to say it over and over and over and over. Yeah, those basic things that we hardly even think of them as intelligence that were like still not there.
Yeah, these are attempts at natural language user interfaces, right?
Yeah.
On the steps there.
Right.
Calling it natural language feels funny to me. I'm assuming there's a technical definition of a natural language UI, but these are sort of scripted things rather than saying, hey, Alexa, what was that movie that Tommy Lee Jones was in 1994 or whatever? You have to say a scripted set of phrases. You learn, we adapt our speech to what they can understand, basically. So it feels unnatural to me, but these are our sort of first attempts.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I think that there's a lot of minds and a lot of dollars being invested in making like that move from the more scripted to the more natural. So we're somewhere like on the spectrum there. And you'll be surprised sometimes like at what you can say. It's not necessarily like super scripted and these things can still understand. And you'll also be surprised sometimes at the things that you say that it won't understand. So I think that's a lot of the confusion is because there are some things that work really, really well. And then other things that work really not well, but they're not what like they don't align with a regular person's intuitions. You were saying like the what Alexa and Google systems do, they are actually like inside, they're really doing like scripts. They have like a certain set of rules, but they are trying to match, like the language can be flexible. So you can say things in a lot of different ways and they can still understand it. With some, you know, limits, of course. But just to give you a feel for like how scripted they are, like I have a friend who's working at Amazon, and like her job is to identify sarcasm, and then like they script like responses. They find the most common like sarcastic responses, and they like script the what they're gonna say to them. So it's not like Alexa's super clever, but she might have like clever people behind the scenes.
Wow! If eventually the AI behind it manages to recognize sarcasm, that's gonna be a leap.
Yeah, sarcasm is intense.
I was being sarcastic.
Oh no! You're supposed to use a sarcastic voice.
We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here. Let's back up a step. Ronan, is there a reasonably concise definition of artificial intelligence?
Well, the colloquial thing is like kind of anything that machines can't do right now. But that's kind of a definition that's like a moving target. So it used to be chess, right? And then like we got machines to do that. And then it was like image recognition, but we got there like a decade ago. So it's like moving. It's part of the complication. This is something that I've encountered in my own academic journey so far, is that we're actually like learning on the way. Like by trying to build it, we're actually learning what constitutes intelligence, and we're finding like time and again surprised by things that we think are intelligence, and then we find that they're maybe not. But just to get this like something to have to hold on to, I would say that what we're kind of starting to see is this kind of ability to very flexibly bring to bear like different problem solving strategies to actually like solve real world problems in a way that's of use to us. The agents we build also have like different goals. So you have some kind of goals and you're navigating the space of actions available to you and using that to accomplish those goals.
Okay, so there's no hard line between a computer that's able to do complex tasks and a computer that we can call intelligent. There's no border between those that we can see, I suppose.
Well, yeah, that brings up a good point. So artificial intelligence, like essentially what we want is some computer that sort of can mimic humans and the ability for thinking and acting. And here, I guess you would have to say that a computer that can do complex tasks is part of the story, but we would kind of expect also the computer can learn, sort of learn from humans, learn from data or from something like that. So complex tasks on its own, they're not enough. And I guess this ability to learn is inherently a part. So if the computer doesn't understand the task, we would expect it to be able to get it some information, new examples or data, and then like be better at doing the task. So learning is essential.
Okay, gotcha. Learning is essential. That's good. That's a motivational poster. That'll be my first merch for the podcast. I suppose some of this seems like it's a problem of our terminology that we're trying to put on it. When is a system intelligent? Well, are dogs intelligent? Are snails? Are wasps? Are people? Caroline, I'm wondering for another bit of terminology. In your opinion, is Jarvis alive? Or if you're more familiar with, let's say, Commander Data from Star Trek or C-3PO or whatever, can we call any of these alive, in your opinion?
That's a difficult question. Just going off of what Ronan just said, the learning aspect to me is sort of, I mean, I was just thinking about it, like that's what separates things that are alive from things that are not, I suppose, is the ability to change and to adapt, which comes about through learning new information. So I don't know. I mean, there's part of me in that sense wants to say, yes, I feel like they are alive to an extent, but something else Ronan said, which was there still have to be clever people behind it. Mm. So can they be alive, or is it the other things that are alive that are behind them that make them alive? I just answered your question with a question, but
I think if you could answer that question, you could probably write a book on it that would sell very well. Or you could probably get a PhD in that question. There's a great episode of Star Trek in the second season called Measure of a Man, where they debate, is Commander Data alive? The judge in the case, there's a court case and there's a judge. She at the end says, I can't answer this question. Who am I to answer this question? Is Data alive? She says, we're kind of asking, does he have a soul? She says, I don't know. I don't know if I do. So how can I say he doesn't? Ronan, as a researcher in this, where do you fall? Do you think we'll ever be able to say an AI is alive?
Yeah, this is definitely fascinating. And I think it's going in the direction of the episode you mentioned right now, honestly.
Is that episode shown in like 101 of AI class?
No, it actually isn't. I wish it was, but yeah, I'll mention that to my lecturers. because but if you do look back at like even to the sort of founding fathers of the field, Alan Turing. Maybe you guys are familiar, probably heard the name, like the guy that cracked the
great movie,
there's Imitation Game, the movie about Enigma. So yeah, he was one of the like pioneers in artificial intelligence. There's the Turing test named after him. Yeah, when asked like the question like, can machines think, he said this should start with like definitions of machine and think. So like we're on shaky ground right from the get-go. And to be honest, like those boundaries are, it's just becoming like even less clear, like what is a machine and what is intelligence? It's not becoming more clear. A lot of research is just showing that these lines are kind of blurring. It's harder to say like what, like are these, you know, machines that are displaying all kinds of intelligent behavior. Like if you try to draw a line and say something that reproduces and like evolves, they're already like, we can show this happening in like artificial life simulation. So everything like we try to pin down becomes, you know, somewhat harder to actually use that as a definition, because then someone's like, oh no, but here we have this like experiment that shows that actually that can also happen in like laboratories. But something that I think is still sort of separates machines and living things, I guess, would say this idea of like having skin in the game.
Literally?
Yeah. I mean, this notion of embodiment, there's still really like a lot of, you know, strong differences between like how, you know, embodied organisms behave and like machines, that like emotions and things like that are still like really far from, we don't see that today. Robots.
Well, I also think it's like the point where every movie about artificial intelligence goes wrong is when the artificial intelligence goes off the plan, right? Whatever like it was created to do, then there's like a point where it's not doing that anymore. It's decided that that's the wrong plan and it comes up with its own plan and starts doing that plan. So I guess maybe that's the point where we could say that it's actually alive, is when it's not following the plan of somebody behind it, but it's following its own.
Having desires, maybe?
Yeah.
Right, its own purpose or agency.
If in order to be considered alive, I have to have a purpose, then I'm going to struggle with that myself. But that actually reminds me, in 2001, for our parents' generation, when they think of artificial intelligence, they think of HAL from 2001: A Space Odyssey. And the reason HAL went crazy and was trying to kill people was that he had conflicting programs, basically. One, keep secrets. Two, do what they say, basically. I think, if I remember the details. And this caused a problem in the programming that wasn't anticipated. So at that level, it's a bit like, well, maybe HAL wasn't even an artificial intelligence. Maybe just a poorly programmed computer with a really good conversational chatbot built in.
Yeah, I think that also brings up an interesting point, is that like our problems start way before we have of things like, you know, Terminator walking around and, you know, trying to kill us. Yeah, like that example kind of shows, is that even just by our inability to really, you know, more precisely define what we actually want our, you know, AI assistant to do, then we can already get ourselves into like these difficult situations. I think we're all seeing it right now, like with social media, for example, because, you know, Facebook, for example, wanted the algorithm that controls, you know, the feed that people see to be engaging, you know, and have people come back and like refresh and look at it and scroll and see what's new. And they didn't think that by, you know, optimizing for that engagement, the algorithm would learn to show people fake content and polarizing content. And it learned essentially that like what people are going to come back and see more of doesn't have to be real. It just has to be like, you know, sensational or crazy or, you know, wild. And then it just like keeps showing people more of that. And then it like makes this self-reinforcing bubble that we are all like experiencing as we speak. So yeah. So, and this is like not anything, I mean, no one's going to say that Facebook's feed algorithm is, you know, anything near like sentient machine or something.
You mentioned chess before, and I think that's a place that real world AI research really kicked off. At least that's when it became famous to me, was when hearing the news the first time that a computer beat a human at chess. I think it was Deep Blue was the most famous one anyway. And now we've got software that has beat humans at ever more complex games, even things like Go, which people said was impossible. So let's say I design a chess program. I want the player to be able to play against the computer, but I don't want to spend my day programming every possible chess move because there are like a gajillion. What are my steps? How do I start making an artificially intelligent chess bot? Actually, hang on. That's a better question for the color commentator. Caroline, if you were going to design this chess bot, how would you go about it?
I'd hire somebody like Ronan to do it. Because I would have absolutely no idea. I'm not a tech person in any sense of the word. But I mean, I guess, if it can actually learn, having it play against other people may be quicker and a more efficient way of it learning different possibilities than trying to think of every possibility and putting it in there yourself.
As somebody with absolutely no expertise in this area either, sounds great to me. Ronan, how's that? Is that a good place to start?
Yeah. I think Carolyn touched on two things that are actually happening in practice. One is that I think the first attempts were looking more at this idea of less of learning, but more of just like being able to search the space of possible options. And because, you know, computers can do those things like much faster than humans can, for games like chess, it could work. So essentially, like the first attempts were just kind of assign, you know, a score somehow to each chess position. And then, you know, given your starting position, you just like search through all the options you can and then like take the best ranked move and then like doing that. And that's one way to more primitive, I guess, approach to building a chess robot. But then I think, as Carolyn said, this would be, you know, really hard, especially if you're scaling up to like the more complex games people are trying to build programs for today, like Go, which is famous and was in the news.
Yeah, 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was DeepMind that now, I think Google bought DeepMind. So it's a Google bot now.
Right. And this is like much more complicated than chess. It's also like a board game, but it's got a lot more possible moves. So those earlier methods weren't going to like crack it. And the insights in Go were to use more human-like intelligence to sort of trim down the search space in sophisticated ways, like using pattern recognition to sort of being able to focus the search into like the more promising parts. And also the other thing, this is what Carolyn mentioned, is this idea of being able to play. And they used a really clever method of having the program like play against itself repeatedly, like playing equivalent to like millions of years of human play, playing against itself and like building upon its own abilities. And I think they bootstrapped it with like data from Go experts that they managed to also collect. So that was like the beginning. And then they used that to sort of build the self-play mechanism.
Wow. There is a great podcast, if that discussion is interesting to anybody else, just called Deep Mind. And it is sort of an advertisement for the company. Not sort of. It definitely is. It's like 8 episodes talking about how great they are. But it's from an outside person, Dr. Hannah Fry. And it's really interesting.
There's also a good movie that was made on like the whole saga of the Go program. And they actually show like footage from the games and you see like the Go masters. It's kind of like wild watching how they kind of, you know, come into this thinking, how could a Go program beat us? And then you see the guy like suddenly realizing that this is playing like insane moves. And you see the person being like crushed. It's pretty intense for like a show about a board game.
That reminds me of something you mentioned earlier, Ronan, was that one of the things we're trying to do with AI is create a human-like intelligence in a machine. And what was really interesting about the Go bot was that those Go masters said it's not playing like a person, like a human. It did things that are different. It did things we would never do. And it was like a different kind of intelligence playing the game rather than a human one. It didn't learn and copy the masters. It made its own way of playing that they hadn't seen before and couldn't respond to, basically. And that weirded me out when I first heard that.
It's not a human mind, man. Mm-mm. I mean, look at this. They're like neurons firing.
I was thinking about this when you originally asked me to do this episode, Dave, and I was thinking about the chess thing. And to me, the first thing I thought of was, well, of course, like a computer is going to eventually be more equipped to beat a person at chess like 9 times out of 10 because the emotion isn't there. Especially when you think about athletes, one of the biggest things is controlling your emotions to not like get in the way of your play. And so I was like, well, yeah, the computer doesn't have emotion. So of course it's going to play completely differently than a person because the person is having to sort through all of the emotional stuff and play at the same time.
Yeah. If you play chess online, what some people did was get a computer chess game to play their game for them. And one of the ways that these online chess providers figured out that they were doing that was they were making moves that humans wouldn't do. Humans will risk a piece. And if that piece's goal is then blocked, humans will leave the piece there because we're stubborn. A program will pull it back immediately because, as you say, it wasn't emotionally attached to the idea of its move.
Yeah, it's like why a lot of economics theory doesn't work, right? Humans aren't rational inherently.
Yeah, I think that kind of brings up this complementary view, which is becoming pretty popular now. I think we're seeing a lot of promise there. And so just to give an example related to Go, then we're seeing like this whole growth of a community of AI-enhanced Go playing. So people are using these as like some kind of like assistant, coach, whatever, and becoming like hybrid, you know, superhuman, super Go supposedly players. Even though I don't think they actually can beat the AI still, but they can actually like improve their play dramatically.
Caroline, one of the things I like to do to color commentators is unfairly quiz them.
Oh boy.
So here we go. What's your best guess at the definition for the term machine learning? It's important to note that I do not know the answer to this, so I can help mix stuff up with you if you like.
I want to use the words in the definition, which you're not supposed to do. Yeah, I suppose it's that the machine has the ability to increase its knowledge and intelligence over time on various topics.
I like it. Increased knowledge and the machine does it. Ronan, to you, what does the term machine learning mean?
Yeah, I think that definition touches on some important stuff that's happening. I would say that another thing I would add is this idea of learning from data. So I guess time in some sense, you know, it's like you get experience over time and experience is kind of like data. But the idea is that the system gets data and then it can improve its performance on some task, like given that data. Like you give it more data, it'll improve more. Yeah, the idea is some algorithm that can use data, can learn patterns and improve its performance through that data.
Okay, gotcha. There's another bit of terminology that gets thrown around a lot, and I think all of us maybe have an idea of what it means, but I don't actually, because I didn't even take math class in 12th grade. At a very basic level, what is an algorithm?
Like in its simple, in the simple form, it's, you could just think of it as like a recipe for how to do some kind of computation. So, you know, like, you know, making a cake, you could think of it like there's an algorithm to make a cake. Like you take, you know, whatever, egg, you take flour, you take milk, you mix things. Put it in the oven, wait a certain amount of time, then you get a cake. It's maybe that, I don't think that cake that I said right now is going to taste very well. But in general, like this idea of, yeah, being able to have like code is like procedure and be able to execute it, that's an algorithm. But obviously real algorithms are really, really complex. I mean, the ones that are useful usually tend to be.
When AI researchers talk about algorithms, I think I've heard the phrase like this algorithm learned this and that, or this algorithm is mm-hmm. for this. Is it more like a set of algorithms are on artificial intelligence, or is each one its own sort of extraordinarily complex intelligence?
I think, you know, if you look at something like Facebook's algorithms for like whatever recommendation for feeds and things like that, I think there are a lot of behind the scenes, there are like a lot of different algorithms doing the work. So it's like one monolithic like agent that's doing everything. So it's a bunch of different algorithms. And this might be like getting a little technical, but like people might be thinking, okay, how is like this recipe for making a cake, how can that like evolve over time? Like it seems to be like a, you know, some fixed set of, you know, instructions. So these learning algorithms, they're mimicking the brain in some sense. So there's not really any, if you look like under the hood, you're not going to find any procedures. Like you'll find artificial neurons, like that's what they're called, artificial neural networks. So it's all layers of these artificial neural networks, and you'll just find like a lot of numbers and mathematical operations that are happening. And indeed, like one of the challenges is sort of to interpret like what these things are actually doing. But yeah, so a lot of the algorithms that we're hearing about today, those state-of-the-art machine learning algorithms, they're not doing anything necessarily interpretable under the hood, which causes a lot of confusion, of course, because we're already starting not to be able to understand that.
At some point, we wrote, not me personally, humans wrote a program, and they said, this thing we're trying to get to understand this task and learn and do something intelligent. All these, as you say, equations and things that we don't know what they're doing, who wrote those?
Yeah, so the idea of these neural networks is like essentially it's pretty simple, is that you have these artificial neurons. For example, let's think of, I don't know, image recognition. So you show them a picture of a dog and like they have to classify, is it a dog or a cat? So you show them a picture of a dog and then they crunch all these numbers. And at the end, there's like this output, and the output is going to be just like a probability that it thinks it's a dog or probability that it thinks it's a cat. So, you know, it says, okay, I think this is, you show it a poodle, and then it says, okay, I think 80% a cat. And what you do is then you have some mathematical way of correcting, like, okay, I'm going to tweak the weights of this, like all these parameters that are defining the neurons, and I'm going to tweak them and make it so that next time the neural network sees the image of this poodle, it's going to assign more probability to dog than cat. And so what happens, like essentially, is with each example, you're like tweaking these weights a little. And by showing thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of examples, you fine tune these weights, and then you get something that's like really good at, you know, classifying dogs or cats or for, you know, a lot more complicated things. But essentially, that's what's like happening. We're like tweaking these number weights. There are analogs, like how are synapses, and we're just like strengthening different weights or weakening weights or things like that. So it's what it's trying to mimic.
Gotcha. Okay. I say gotcha, like, I understand that now, and I'm going to go research some artificial intelligence. I understand your analogy. Good enough for me, I think. Caroline, does the concept of artificial intelligence worry you? The idea that humanity might create a whole other kind of life and just let it loose in the world? I mean, because if you couldn't tell from the leading way I phrased that, it wigs me out a little bit sometimes.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think you could tell from my beginning story that I clearly am a little bit nervous about machines becoming everyday parts of our lives. I think it's also all these movies about it. But, you know, like most of these artificial intelligence movies, they're designed to like play on your emotion of like one of these days the machines are going to realize that like humans are incredibly flawed and like we don't need them anymore. Yeah, it freaks me out a little bit. But at the same time, like I hear Ronan talk about it and it doesn't sound like we're like close to Terminator at this point. You know what I mean? So, I mean, maybe it's going to be a while before we see that. So maybe at least in my lifetime, I'm not going to be worried about it. But maybe like in my children's lifetime or something, my children that don't exist. It is a little unsettling. But at the same time, like there's always like different ways to look at things. It also probably creates a lot of opportunities for cool and interesting things as well. I mean, obviously people like it enough to let it into their house and like help them accomplish daily tasks or have more fun also. And I guess for me, I was thinking too, as we were having this conversation, what I do in international development is inclusion work. So working with gender and youth, there's been this conversation about, we think that machines don't have emotion and so therefore they don't have bias, these inherent issues that people have. But I don't know if that's actually true. And there's been like some interesting articles I've read lately around the fact that because this artificial intelligence is being created by people or because it's learning from people, that it's picking up racism, for instance, like it picks up on that and then projects that. That in my like professional life also worries me a little bit because we're trying to like undo some of these things. And, you know, I don't want it to be perpetuated in this new space.
Yeah, I think that gets back to something that Ronan started out talking about at the beginning of the recording, is that he said that Google will have trouble recognizing that his friend Amit's mm-hmm. name is a name because it's not a white North American name.
Right.
I think about this sometimes with my customers. I type their names into my app for work and my keyboard autofills a lot of the white names and doesn't autofill a lot of the other names. I mean, it has Johnson and Thompson and whatever. And it doesn't have, like, Ronan, I don't think it would have your last name. I don't know. Although maybe it would because it's also...
They might, like soy sauce. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that the biases of the programmers are inevitably in there.
Your mind is made up of a complex construct of overlays. Jarvis, Ultron, Tony, me, the stone. All of them mixed together. All of them learning from one another.
Yeah, this is like the like common fears are, you know, Terminator, but they're actually like the problems are way before that. And I think that it's like these kinds of algorithmic bias issues are things that we're seeing right now and they're urgent and they're getting a lot of attention. All those things you guys were mentioning, and there are more. There's like the issues of facial recognition that like it works better on,
yeah,
on white people and black people. There are like all kinds of algorithms that know how to morph your face. So you can like take a man's face and like turn it into a woman, or all kinds of crazy stuff. Make a woman's face and make it younger, or make it older, or all kinds of crazy things. And those algorithms also, they have like all kinds of crazy biases where they'll take a black person's face and then make it look whiter because that's what they just saw more of in the data. That's like the, I guess, bad side, you know, that we're seeing all these cases of algorithmic bias and there's a lot of misuse. Maybe the optimistic view on that is that it's like bringing these things right to the fore and like making a lot of public discussion on it and sort of reflecting to us. Like some people say that the technology is kind of like a mirror. So like when we're unleashing these algorithms on the internet and they're like mirroring back all the like all the junk and like all, you know, the racism and everything that's like in this, all this messy data. So it's kind of like, forcing us maybe to, you know, rethink these things and actually like do something about them if we really want to be able to use these, you know, systems to make our lives better and not like worse.
Related to something else Caroline said, Ronan, what are some of the technical barriers that we're facing before we're able to, well, get Jarvis in our house? What's the leap between Alexa and Jarvis?
Yeah, so I think, yeah, your question touches like one of them. I think language understanding is turning out to be much harder than people thought it would be, maybe like underestimated. So, you know, we've gotten really good at being able to like, you know, recognize different objects or animals in images and audio recognition. We're doing pretty well, but language is something that seems like it's the abilities of our like language processing algorithms are still like really limited. It's kind of like one of the current sort of big challenges of the next coming years. Like, how can we get better at that? Actually, I think there's like a lot of over-optimism. Like people tend to think these things are easier than they are. And I think that should maybe be comforting to those of us who are like maybe worried that, you know, robots are like on the verge of overtaking the world. A lot of it is really good PR by the big tech companies that know how to spin the stories.
Caroline, have you heard of the singularity as it relates to AI?
No, I don't think so. Or if I have, I didn't dig into it enough to actually understand it. So
if you had to guess based on the name, somebody's writing their sci-fi book and they say, yeah, I'm putting in the singularity. What would you assume they were talking about?
I'm going to guess that it's like the idea that it is a thing separate from other things, sort of like as a human, you are a human that is separate from other humans and you have the ability to act and decide and do.
Okay. So
that's
like,
what I'm going
like
to guess.
Singleness. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. That actually, it gets to a little bit because at the end of it is going to be something so different from us, we sort of can't relate to it. So it's the idea that some people see as inevitable. Once we create an AI that has the ability to create an AI, and then that AI creates another and another and another, they call it an intelligence explosion. As each generation of AI creates another in increasingly rapid succession, so that in 5 minutes, you're 6 million generations down, each generation would then be more and more alien to us, more and more separate from something we could understand. And then, of course, in sci-fi, it then destroys the world. But Ronan, the AI community, from what I can tell, seems to be split on whether or not the singularity is impossible or inevitable. Where do you fall? What do you think?
I wouldn't put too much money on that one. I guess I'm more on the impossible side. Yeah, it tends to be like there tends to be this thread in AI research of people that are really over-optimistic about like how fast we're going to achieve, you know, this kind of super intelligence. Yeah, it's pretty funny. Like you can look back, the 50s, you can see like different protocols of like meetings of different scientists, really famous scientists too. And they're like, yeah, I think we'll put 10 people on this project. And over the summer, we'll probably have a machine that can like understand human language. They were like that optimistic. Literally, that's almost like what they were thinking.
Over the summer. And now since then, like 2,000 people have gotten their PhDs in that
topic, more than
attempting
2000.
To do the first part of it. That's amazing.
Right. Yeah. And it goes on, you know, like you can find Elon Musk saying, you know, we're going to have these self-driving cars, you know, I don't know, he was saying it back in whatever, 2015 or 16, like we're going to have them in like 2 years or something. And here it's turning out to be a lot harder than people thought. Singularity, I think it runs into a lot of, there are a lot of problems with it. You know, one of them is this idea of like bodies. So something that's disembodied, it's not really clear. If so much of intelligence is tied to having a body, then where do we even think that, like, what are these things even going to like manifest? Where is this intelligence going to even manifest itself? And yeah, none of the things we're working on today right now seem to be doing much of sort of creating really new kinds of intelligence. What we're doing today is mostly taking fixed kind of architectures and then like giving them lots of data. So that's not making anything that's really new. The only way we're kind of surprising ourselves is by like what something that learns from so much data can actually like do, like integrating all that data. But it's not really making anything new in terms of like a new architecture or a new agent with new goals or anything. There's like no goals or purpose anywhere in these systems.
You haven't yet created new life.
No.
Okay. If that was a yes, that was going to break on this podcast. So next up, we have a segment in the show called Technically. Caroline and I are going to keep quiet for 2-3 minutes as Ronan gives us some nuance or details on anything related even tangentially to the topic. Ronan, you have the floor.
I guess it's kind of related to what we were talking about earlier. It's just, I think, some concept that I found that was sort of helpful in kind of guiding me and helping me sort of understand with all these like crazy ideas out there. And it's called Moravec's paradox. This is, I think, from the 1980s, an AI researcher called Hans Moravec. And he said that it's easy to make computers do things that are like playing checkers or perform, you know, all kinds of algebra or like word problems, things that we tend to think are like difficult, but it's hard to give them the skills of even like 1-year-old when it comes to perception or mobility or things like that. Another way to think of it is that the things that are hardest to reverse engineer are the things that are unconscious. We're not really even aware of how we do all these things. And it kind of equates to the fact that the things that we thought were challenging were tended to be the things that educated male scientists thought were challenging. And that was like, you know, playing chess or things like that. And it turns out those aren't the hard things. So the hard things are the things that were evolving for, you know, millions and millions of years, like moving. And we're still not understanding those really, really hard things. So I think that kind of flips the argument and it helps sort of understand how much more we still have to do because we need to understand all these really subconscious things. And if we're going to language, then language recruits a lot of these subconscious abilities. So this is also something that I didn't really realize at the start of my research. And now I'm much more appreciative of. So because language uses all these subconscious things and because of Moravec's paradox, which tells us that all these subconscious things are really hard, it's a warning light that reverse engineering language is also going to be really hard. So there's still time before the eclipse of the robots.
Oh, good. There we have time. Caroline, close us out. What are your final thoughts on AI?
Thank you, Ronan, for all of the great information. I think you've made me a little less concerned about Terminator being a real thing one of these days, or Ultron, or any of that. At the same time, I think you've presented me with like a new concern and a new thing that I want to research more about and maybe look into and see like what I personally, you know, can do about it, which is this algorithmic bias, which is, I think, really interesting. And given some of the things that are going on in our world today, ever more important. You just made a point about it was what white male scientists thought were hard. And so I think that also kind of gets at this idea of why it's so important to continue to get more girls into STEM education and get more diverse populations from around the world into STEM education. And maybe that'll help us solve some of these language barrier issues and inherent bias issues as well. Because I think, like you said, that's really the problem before Terminator. I'll be looking into more of that and seeing, you know, how I can think about that in my daily work, because we're constantly thinking about how do we apply technology to solve some of the problems that people in other countries face. Sometimes I wonder if we're doing enough of our own due diligence about those technologies before we do that, and the tangential problems that they could create as well.
This is like, I think that's a really, really good point, and also maybe to end on that, in like the AI research community, it's also becoming like apparent that we really need to bring in like more diversity. And there's like these, a lot of people now thinking about how we make it more cross-disciplinary, and we understand that like it's not good to just have like computer scientists think about ethics, and it's probably better to have a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds thinking about it together. And it means that like people from the humanities need to learn more about, you know, computer science and vice versa. Yeah. So everyone kind of needs to readjust this like cross-disciplinary thinking will move us forward.
That's a great note to end on. Caroline, something you said reminded me that when Sally Ride first went into space, she was going for 6 days, I think, and NASA engineers gave her a box of 100 tampons. She was like, this might be too much. I know we like backups, but whoa, guys. I want to be clear, as always, that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Caroline Bailey and Ronan Tamari, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers there's an episode 13. That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to my guests, Ronan Tamari and Caroline Bailey. The way they made this topic relevant and relatable means a lot to me. I'd like to ask you a favor. Share this episode with one friend you think would like it. And if you want to go a step further, I'll ask what every small podcast asks. Rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. MCU audio clips were taken from Avengers Age of Ultron, Avengers Infinity War, and Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and all used entirely without permission. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. Check out more info about each episode and its guests, including upcoming episodes, at davereinersman.com/marvelsofscience. You can also find the podcast at patreon.com/marvelsofscience. And now find me on Twitter at marvelsoscience, not of science, o science. See you next week, and thanks for listening.
Algorithm.
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 Algorithm.